podcast has changed my life.
Chad, it's lovely to meet you.
Yes, nice to be met.
Come on, sit down, tuck in.
Not friends, but they didn't hate each other in any
yeah.
way.
Yeah. Do you have any comedy nemesis?
Yeah, you would for sure. Like,
I mean, well, not so much anymore. I feel like I've been on the apology circuit for the last 5 years.
Oh, really?
Like the AA apology circuit. I was like, I'm really sorry. I was like really in a bad place when I talked shit about you without realizing you were right behind me at the time. I did a lot of like, you know, because I came into comedy like really fucking like I'm the best,
sure.
you know, just and it was all just a fucking smokescreen to block out the fear.
Okay.
But also, I think it's like a real testament to how fucked up you can get when you're quite young and lots of people are telling you you're very good before you've even really
was built. That happening to you?
Yeah, like you know, there was a lot of that. Like, whoa, he's a fucking firecracker. He's going off the crowd. Like, whoa,
they called you a firecracker.
Yeah. really condescending, yeah. right?
What a skirt over there. Yeah, that's quite. Is that condescending?
I never liked it because it was that thing of like, well, I don't even know who I am. Like, basically, the reason I'm railing and yelling at the crowd is because I'm fucking terrified.
Totally.
And I'm gripping onto the microphone for dear life.
Maybe that's what maybe every firework is scared.
Yeah, they're terrified.
No, that's why New Year's Eve is the saddest night of the year.
Yeah, and the explosion is the manifestation of the panic attack. But, yeah, and so whatever. I think it all goes to our heads. I think no one gets into comedy because they're really sure of themselves. I think that's the great kind of paradox of it, right? Mm. You seem like you have to be very confident to do it. But really, like, you know, how confident can you be if you need a room full of strangers to tell you you're a good boy every night?
Sure. Dude, that's so true.
Yeah, and so, like,
actually,
lots
of, so true.
It is, right?
I mean,
for me,
I feel like being in the room with a couple of anomalies.
Tom's a confident fella.
Very confident boys.
No, what you say? Oh, I mean, no, but that's the, that's definitely the thing that you're trying to quench by doing it. It's like approval from others. And anyone who needs that much, there's a problem. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I feel more confident in my own self, whether that's just from age or whatever.
Mm.
And I don't think it's a coincidence that I gig less. Or no, that's not true. That I don't feel like I need to gig as much.
Yeah.
It's not like that, like, oh God, if I don't gig for a week, I'm like, who am I? What am I? Am I good? You know, the idea of externalizing my sense of self to remove strangers doesn't seem as it seems a bit sick.
But these beefs, let's get back to these beefs.
Oh, I don't want to talk about my beefs.
Have you got caught like saying shit about someone in front of someone?
Yeah.
Oh,
dude, my I was only doing comedy for like a year and a half before I got chosen for Comedy Zone.
Right.
And
that's a great show. Mm. You've done that, Tom?
Oh, we've all been in Comedy Zone?
Oh, yeah. No anomalies here for that particular issue.
Okay, let me ask you. Did you guys know what it was when you got... Like, were you savvy enough about the industry to know that you'd been chosen for a thing?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Right.
I got the call going.
You got a phone call.
I got a phone call from Melbourne Comedy Festival going, we've chosen you for Comedy Zone. And I was like, I don't know what Comedy Zone is. And I'd been to an audition... Maybe not an audition, like a showcase a month before. And this is like O'Kine was there, Eastgate was there, like lots of people that have careers now or not were there. And I had a fucking meltdown at the audition because 2 days earlier, my grandparents' corpses had to be exhumed from their graves and reburied because there was some kind of like tidal leakage in the grave. And my mother had gone to visit this is a true story.
You've created a new type of trauma. I've never heard of that. Your grandparents getting it. I thought you were going to say died. No, they're getting battered.
It was wild. I'll back up. So my grandfather died, and in Jewish tradition, the stone doesn't go up for a year.
Okay.
Okay.
So you got some time.
As in the gravestone.
The gravestone. So you got some time to kind of compose a nice thing, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
So for a good year, there's just a mound of dirt before the whole thing goes up. And my mum, who was quite deranged with grief at the time, would go to the grave quite a bit. And she went there one night just as the sun was going down and stepped on my grandfather's grave, the dirt, to place flowers on she stepped on the dirt of my grandmother's grave to place flowers on my grandfather's grave.
Sure.
And started like...
Oh my God. Sinking quicksand
style into her mother's grave. And she's a little woman. She's only like 4'10". So she's there going like... like sinking down. And like, no joke, I saw her after it. There was
the most terrifying thing I've ever heard of in my entire life. Sure.
Dude, it's like fucking, yeah, like mud up to her tit line. Like she went all the way down. Like seriously, she sunk fucking deep.
Oh,
and like,
oh my God.
And I always like to think of it, like, because a passing grave digger had to yank her out. And I'm thinking from his perspective,
a
he's just driving.
Grave digger.
He's like on his little golf cart driving by and some like reanimated corpse. Like, and so she gets yanked out of that. And it was one of those incidents, like, you know how sometimes incidents are so fucked up and traumatic that all you can do is laugh? Like, it's totally. So fucked up. And so anyway, it turned out there was a burst water main that was
flooding, and then that made it kind of wet
soil into quicksand. And so they had to be, and it was fucking gnarly. Like, it was hazmat tents and everything. People in, like, biohazard suits.
Mm.
And, you know.
You went to the exhuming?
Well, we went to the reburial, but we got there.
I've got to do it all again. Just sort it out.
No, it was just me and my mum and my great aunt.
Did you say some words?
I had a holy moment, but we'll get to that in a second. So I think everyone...
oh, I met God, but not yet, Sam.
We've got to build to the meeting of God.
I met the devil first. My mum met the devil, then I met God.
I think for the rest of the family, it was so fucked up that they just...
Mm.
They were just like, I'm out. Count me out of this one. This is too messed up to even.
Well, they didn't want to go back to it. But
they wouldn't even acknowledge it. Like, oh, we'd talk about it, and they, you know, they would just change the subject. Mm. It's like, I mean, it was off the back of a fucking heinous few years. Life was just really kiboshing me and mum over and over again.
Gotcha.
And so this was the kind of like the final coda. Mm.
Yeah.
So 2 days after. So anyway, the hazmat team came, had to exhume them. And of course, I love mum very much, but she's very naive. Very naive. And
for example, she never thought she would sink.
I don't think that is an example of naivety. That is the most unlikely thing I've ever heard of, and I don't think I would fear it, or anyone should reasonably fear it.
Everyone knows when you go to a graveyard, keep your wits about you. You could end up tits deep.
I do like the sentence "sinking tits deep into your mother's grave." But you know, we got there, and she was just like, "I want to see them. I want to look at them."
No.
And it's like, no, you really don't. And I kind of, my head goes to those places. So obviously I was thinking like, well, their bodies are going to be in a pretty fucking horrible state.
How long
have
they been down there?
My grandparent must at that stage have been down for like a year and a half.
Right.
So he wouldn't be bones yet.
Arguably the worst time to see them, really.
I would say less so for her. I imagine that he would have been like slightly, you know, maybe mummified. Not mummified, but the... All the kind of subcutaneous fat and everything probably would have been drained off by then. I mean, she would have been in a...
How do you know this? Were you Googling this at the time?
Well, I've watched documentaries on body farms and decomposition and stuff and how long it takes.
So they're in coffins.
Yeah, but like Jew coffins aren't those like fancy mahogany.
I've been to a Jewish funeral.
Everyone gets the same kind of very plain black box. And you're naked, you're wrapped in a shroud. There's clay from Israel on your head.
Yeah.
So I had to kind of explain to mum...
So
like,
these things going wrong are all kind of built into the religion. Just saying. There's a few factors here. The lack of the stone and the covering over the thing.
It's like weird cardboard.
I reckon this is the first time this has happened.
Jewish death is that it's supposed to be humbling, so everyone ends up... Well, there's nothing more humbling than a leakage and you having to get
back up. Look, in the end, it was very beautiful because they went down together.
I thought you said rematch.
So they got reburied and they both got lowered at the same time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was...
And there's an opportunity to say goodbye again,
I thought it was very beautiful. You know, at one point the sun hit the black lids of their coffins and it seemed to glow
and
with
they
light.
Caught on fire and you did the whole process again.
And two willy wagtails kind of like flitting around the place. Yeah, like, there's this spirit.
That's all that stuff.
It was very beautiful. But anyway, like... As funny as the whole situation was, it was kind of fucking traumatizing. So 2 days later, I go to Melbourne.
You're in front of the graves, praying. Please, God, let me get Comedy Zone. What are you praying for, Ben? Shut up, Mum. None of your fucking business.
Keep being traumatized. Keep weeping. So I go to Melbourne to audition for a show. I don't even know what I'm auditioning for.
You used to go to Melbourne to audition for Comedy Zone?
Well, evidently that's what was happening. I didn't know that. I just got a call saying, would you like to do a showcase in Melbourne? Melbourne.
Gotcha.
And I was like, yeah, I'll take a gig. And I had friends in Melbourne, so I was with them.
Yeah.
And I showed up to the gig, and everyone was like really serious, like really taking this very. And I was like, fucking. I mean, you guys have seen
it. It's like the Olympic tryouts. Comedy Zone is a showcase comedy show, by the way, at the Melbourne Comedy
Well, it's supposed to make your career if you get into it.
I mean,
it.
I don't think.
I don't know if they promise. Yeah. Maybe they were when you were doing it. I mean, it's a good thing.
Well, I was in Comedy Zone with Hannah Gadsby and Celia Piccola, so evidently, you know, it's been very well for those guys. But anyway,
that's a good year.
It was a good lineup. Yeah. So
more than one firecracker.
So you guys have
don't know if anyone's ever said that about Hannah Gadsby, to be fair.
A firecracker.
She's a firecracker. Not. There'd be a review in, like, Variety or something saying she's a firecracker. Firecracker.
Australian firecracker Hannah Gadsby.
Firecracker? I thought it was mainly about your, like, upward kind of manic mood.
I don't think it's a term
she's
for
just
comedy
less manic
at all. So gotcha. I think maybe someone would just use it if someone was doing well.
Yeah. I caught a firecracker all the fucking time.
Yeah.
Came out there, fucking yeah, fucking assholes. Oh, what a firecracker. Actually, unhinged drug addict, but whatever, I'll take firecracker. So I think both of you have seen me stressed out before a gig.
Like, oh,
it's
yeah.
Not, it's not good.
No, it's great.
And it's very, like, very,
if it's not you, it's oppressive. Like, for us, it's fine.
I find it quite humorous.
So I remember getting a lot of sneers from people like, who the fuck is this guy?
So you're putting it together that this is serious.
Well, but just based on everyone's reaction, yeah, they exactly, all seem like, this isn't a normal show. And I'm like, I don't really know what this is. And so I went out on stage and did my first joke, which died, and then kind of went, oh, well, fuck you all. You don't know what my week's been. And started telling them the story about my dead grandparents.
Dude, it's actually the scene in every stand-up comedy movie. Yeah.
And everyone's like, oh, brilliant. Oh. And 2 days later, I get a call going, oh, you're in Comedy Zone. And I'm like, what's Comedy Zone? And so I had to ring on, like, my friend, like, Sam Bowring and people like that, going, like, what is this? And I'm like, dude, take it. It's really good. So anyway, I went to fucking Melbourne, having put in no real effort into comedy, melting down on stage, not really knowing what the fuck I was doing.
You're being rewarded for
being unhinged.
Strange behavior.
Yeah, and like
you would think you were kind of God's gift.
And everyone thinking at the time, like, oh, he's.
They thought you were artistic.
Well, yeah, this is under control.
They thought you were gifted.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, okay.
Cut above the rest.
So I thought I was great, and at the time was very anti the establishment and all these fucking hack comics and fuck this. And I would just sit at town hall fucking railing about people that I'd never met. Or that I'd met once that were really kind to me.
As in with mates?
Or just at people. Fuck this person, that person's a fuck. And there was like two separate occasions where I turned around and the person was fucking right there.
Yeah, I mean, that's where lots of people are. Of course. The big board.
But I've never been to Melbourne. I didn't know that's where everyone hung out.
Nowhere in the country you'd be more likely to run into someone.
I was consumed. And also I had a lot of resentment about the whole thing because within two shows I realised that they realized that they'd made a terrible mistake choosing me for the show.
Kind of
told me that, was just like, you know, like.
They told you.
Well, they said to me, you're the firecracker. You have to open the show every night. They literally said this. You have to open the show. No MC. You just come out and fucking go. And I'm like, no, that's a terrible mistake. You're the angry one. And it's like, no, but I don't know what I am. I've only been doing this for like 18 months. I have no idea what I do. I know people laugh when I get angry.
Totally. And that's within the confines of it's like already a kind of a normal comedy show and then you getting a bit crazy. That kind of makes sense because you're subverting something. Yeah, but you're like at the beginning, thought. It's like, who left, like, who let him in?
They should bring you on third and introduce you and say, hey, this guy's the firecracker. Then it would go well. Exactly. You can't open with the firecracker.
Ironically, that's like getting a comedian to perform before a bunch of firecrackers.
Or doing the countdown after the fireworks.
Like, exactly. And then our big favourite thing, the numbers. Well, no, the numbers is more of a lead-in.
So I get on, like, I think it was like, whatever, four nights, and just eat shit.
It can be hard. I remember that it can be hard opening gigs.
Oh, but no MC. It was just like, welcome to the stage, welcome to the Comedy Zone, and welcome to the stage, the firecracker. Like, you're fucking, you're all shit.
It's so weird there was no MC.
Well, it changed very quickly. So I died in the ass four nights, and then on the fifth day, I was so disillusioned and so upset. So I got fucked up on weed and muscle relaxants and did the show and crushed. Because I was just wasted. And the producer comes up to me, and I was like buzzing, like, finally, I fucking got a win.
And the producer... and also because of all the weed and muscle.
Yeah, and I'm like fucking feeling great.
And I was feeling good after that. Yeah, I think it was the gig. It was really spurred on by the performance.
It was a melange. And the producer of the show comes up to me furious. Yeah. Like, you were clearly off your head.
Oh,
I'm like,
right.
That doesn't matter because I killed. Mm. And he's like, no, you need to be able to do it sober.
Yeah.
And I asked, how many times have you seen me perform before he chose me for this gig? And he was like, probably half a dozen. And I was like, well, I've never been sober on stage.
Yeah.
Like, I'm always wasted. And he very clearly said in that moment, I would not have chosen you had I known that.
Totally.
This is like less than a week into a month-long run.
Yeah.
So I was, you know...
Performance-enhancing drugs.
Dude, like in comedy, sometimes booze or weed or whatever it is. Mm. I think that the time I fuck up the part in the past is treating any gig as this sacred thing and then suddenly changing the behavior that I would have normally approached the gig with.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like when I used to do a lot of weed, you know, sometimes, whatever, you'd have like a fucking support spot somewhere.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I was like, oh, you better not fucking smoke the night before. And it's like, no, don't do that.
Yeah,
you're like
consecrating
this thing as this. And all of a sudden your rhythm's thrown off. Just do what you would normally do.
Totally.
You know.
I often think, sometimes you shouldn't think about it till minutes before you go on, because comedy's all about being in the moment.
Totally.
So you don't want to, visualizing things beforehand can be very much to your detriment.
Oh, when I see people rehearsing lines backstage, I mean, whatever works for you, but for me that's like death.
Mm.
Death. You know, I'd go into recitation mode and...
Totally.
You know, all of a sudden you're very aware of what's the next line and say, does just fucking go.
Mm. But I guess that's totally. It. I mean, it depends what people do. That's not what my thing. But some people do that and are very good at it. It is kind of like script and monologue-y type thing, and they decide they can make it work.
Not all of us's grandparents were exhumed the day before the big gig.
You know, that's all I'm saying. Say, I've got great motivation.
But then, so you were caught during that kind of period, bitching about a few people, and then you mentioned an apology tour.
Mm. I've done multiple apology tours, and I've been doing this.
How
like
do people take
years.
The apologies?
That's the beautiful. You know what? The beautiful. Whenever I read like the once a year article about like comedy, the comedy community is so toxic.
Mm. Oh,
like,
yeah, I love those articles. They're so crazy.
Well,
who are these people writing?
Of course, there's elements that are toxic. There's elements that of every community that are toxic. But I've never met a more
You know the good thing about those articles as well?
Yeah, totally.
Those articles are all written by the successful people in the community.
Of course. Yeah. The people with no
Truly goodness. Reflecting on it as it stands, as opposed to bearing any sort of grudge or personal vendetta that kind of proves the point they're trying to make, the general point about them personally.
Yeah. But I found people are very... I mean, I think this is the... You know, there's this real thing of... and maybe it's dying now because of Trump taking it to the nth degree, but this idea of like never admit fault. And from my experience of life, if you got, unless you've done something truly heinous, but if you've just been a fucking idiot and you know, said shitty things or whatever, if you go to people and go, hey man, I'm really sorry, like I was in a really bad place, and like, it's first of all, it's very personally liberating. Like it's like, you know, I'm a human being and I could make mistakes and da da da. But I've never had anyone go, fuck off.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Most of the time, people are just like, it's fine.
Mm,
and conversely, I mean, you know, I mean, comedy's not as crazy as it used to be, but, you know, people used to get really fucking wasted and shoot their mouths off and do all kinds of stuff. So
people
I've had apologies from
time.
People, like...
But, you know, like, do people say that comedy used to be crazy for drugs and alcohol? I think it's still pretty bad a lot of the time. I see people drinking, getting wasted. How bad could it have been before?
Look, I don't know, because I hardly do comedy anymore. But,
yeah,
like,
right.
It used to be, like, fucking... Like, people used to do acid on stage and just tank gigs and have meltdowns on stage. And, like, it was... I mean, I'm not saying it was, like, fucking crazy punk rock, woo!
Yeah.
But it was clearly a group of broken fucking people, addicts.
Totally.
You know, working out their shit on stage. Like, that old cliche of, ooh, comedy's therapy. I think for a long time, people really thought comedy is therapy. And I'd actually have a responsibility to the audience or to the showrunner to put on a good show. I'm working some shit out, man.
Totally.
That's so interesting. I don't know, like, because I feel like it's probably changing now. I see like a lot of new comedians coming now.
Yeah.
With like kind of very serious, like they don't drink, and it's like, you know, much more of a kind of like, there's an, I guess because there's a pathway.
It's a viable path now.
Yeah, whereas like, maybe not at the moment because of COVID, like everything's tits up, but like, that is interesting to hear that it was.
I mean, it sounds like nihilism.
Yeah, nihilism, but I think it was the acceptance of the reality that unless you are willing to, I don't know, not conform, I hate, whatever, like, pare yourself down to be acceptable on a network television show, you're probably not going to get a career.
But there was also no pathway, really.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was, like, nothing.
You know, maybe you get a panel gig on Spicks and Specs or something, which could lead to something else, but, you know, I mean, the upper positions are pretty locked down.
It's,
you know, the eight people that have, you know, millionaires out of comedy in Australia and that's whereas now, I mean, we've got friends who started an open mic in Sydney who have Adult Swim shows. It's fucking crazy. Totally. It's great. It's great. And it's the dream that, you know, that has always been. But now it actually is possible.
Totally.
Like Aaron Chen's got a fucking Adult Swim.
Yeah.
It's fucking great.
It's ironic because he's the only adult I know who can't swim.
He's a terrible swimmer. He's truly
not quite. He can. But no, he's not great though. So the joke, I stand by it.
No, he's a bad swimmer.
Yeah. But he can. Like he'll get in there.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
He'll get in, which is a problem with bad swimmers.
It's the second episode that just booed him into a pool.
Exactly.
I remember and we're back.
I was having lunch and Cambo came up to me, unbeknownst to me, and was standing right behind me and was looking at what I was doing on my phone, just having lunch at a cafe around here.
I'm having Cambo sneak up behind you.
And then he called me, and I had somewhere to be in like 3 minutes.
Oh, no.
And so I like just saw him calling and looked around, because that's happened to me before where people call you when they can see you and see whether you screen the call.
Yeah.
So I did do, like, I looked 180 degrees, but he was literally right behind me. And I'm like, and just put my phone down and then tap, tap, tap. I'm like, oh, get fucked. I knew it. Fucking knew it. I didn't look 360. I got to look 360.
Unbelievable. Never think you're
never
done
safe.
Behind.
You never, I mean.
God, that's such a Cambo thing to do.
It's has that happened to you? Getting
what?
People checking whether you screen their call. I'm so, a friend of mine did it in high school.
I got that shitty little Nokia phone. And I don't think, like, you know, no one gives a fuck. I don't know. People that call me regularly know that I don't answer my phone a lot.
You know, under no obligations to answer a phone call. I don't think.
Neither.
It's like, just send a text message.
But can I say, it wouldn't be easy to, if I did that as a joke to a friend, not thinking about the screening, and then I saw them go, ugh, and press no immediately. I mean, imagine if you heard them go, ugh.
But I'll do it sometimes if I'm just in the middle of a text. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, me too.
It's so easy to send
a
phone call. I mean, to ring someone. It's like, you don't have to answer the phone.
I agree.
It's not worth
it. It wouldn't be easy to see.
I think the fear of not being seen by someone you respect and like in the way you would like to be, right?
Sure.
Like, you would think that someone that you really like would be like, oh, sick.
Mm.
Oh. Can't wait to speak to you. But, like,
have you ever overheard people talking about you?
Good question. No. No. But I think that's something that every comic and, like,
not even human, I think every person.
Yeah, every person. But I think in comedy, because we all know that everyone talks about everyone, and it's like the schoolyard.
Well, yeah, what are you talking about?
You don't think so?
No.
I mean, really? I do, but that I don't think everyone. Toxic. I don't think people are talking about me.
Talking like in the terms of bitching, but everyone's like, if you perform in front of people for years on end, everyone's going to have an opinion of you.
Yeah.
As
it is inevitable, isn't it?
Like, it's true.
It's not ideal,
but it's true.
Even the shittiest gig, there's like five people there that kind of know you, going, oh, here we go.
Yeah, of course. Like, and especially if they're people that you've fucking eaten shit in front of, like, over and over and over. I mean, that's ruined so many gigs for me.
Totally.
There's some comic in the room where it's like, oh, they've heard that I'm quote-unquote good, but they've only ever seen me eat shit.
Yeah.
And then now that's fucking with my head of, like, I've got something to prove.
Mm. Oh, the other comic, the albatross thing about comics is awful.
Oh,
you
dude.
Know, the one that's there that you always bomb in front of.
When Kappa first started doing comedy, he came up to me after, like, 6 months, and he's like, mate, everyone tells me you're a great comic, and I've only ever seen you fucking humiliate yourself.
What the fuck?
But I've had that a couple of times. I think
it's rare the person tells you that. It's usually the person performing who notes that every time a certain person is there, they don't do very well. It's not often the person telling you.
He's a motherfucker. I've known him for so many years, and if I die in front of him, he still avoids me like I've got fucking contagious cancer.
Yeah,
like,
but you should. I would avoid you if you die. I'd avoid anyone if they die. Like, I'm not talking to them. It's
really
awkward. Yeah.
You can't just do the...
If it's like, you would take it well, but if it's someone, a comedian I don't know that well,
you just want to kind of stay away. That's something Rathy said to me once. He's like, when I'm at a show, I just want to do well enough where people talk to me. He It's like, if I do too bad, everyone just leaves me alone. I don't have any friends.
That is the goals in comedy, really.
That seemed like a new thought to you, that everyone would have an opinion of you.
Well, no, it just made me remember once, I think the first year I did Melbourne, a solo show. I was in this room in the Victoria Hotel, and there was like no... Like, you just have to... I think you've done that room, Tom.
Mm.
That little one, the fixed bar. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you know the room?
Yeah. I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like... There's nowhere to go. You just have to be in this little thing side of the stage. It's like essentially just a curtain blocking out this little mic you can do a backstage. And I remember doing shows, and then after the show, you just can kind of hear the audience coming in. You can hear the audience leaving as well. And just like the amount of times, like, I would be listening when they come in and they're like, we don't know who this guy is. And then after, you think you had a good show, and you just have to, you're stuck in this spot, and you've just got to listen to some people be like, loved it. And other people be like, yeah, I did it. Not really. It was a bit long.
I legitimately that year started with, I can fucking hear you, first of all. Like, people, often be like, this better be fucking good or something. You hear someone like that, man, and they sound like big and like angry to be there because their girlfriend dragged them there or something. You're like, great. Yeah. And then, I, at the end, I'm like, I'm going to be able to hear you.
You told
do
them
not
that.
Be, I'm like, don't comment on it until you're out of the room. Like, it's happened too many times. It's awkward. I'm standing literally right there in the space that's about the size of a shower with a curtain between you and me. Like, I'm not going back into some big complex.
Oh, that's so funny. That is great. Because I did a show at the Comedy Store on Friday, and then I caught up with some people after the show. Some people I hadn't really met before. Turned to them, and they were just like, just being like, I like this bit, I didn't really like that bit, I like this bit, I like, they're just going through things they like. And I was like, I didn't think that was, like, could you just say it was good, or it was, well done, you were up there for an hour. Can you say that?
Just
say you stood up there for an hour.
See, this is the trouble, though, because that's why I like showcases as an audience member, and that I like taking friends to them and stuff. I feel like a big part of why people enjoy comedy is they get to... chat to their friends about who their favourites were, because sense of humour is quite like a personal thing. But also, when you're judging humour, it's like you're judging the person more than a lot of other art forms, because they're kind of talking about themselves and telling. So a lot of the time when people don't like someone, they're just like, I fucking hated that guy. It's not even about the jokes or the writing or anything 100%. Or the performance. It's just like, ugh, we don't like that kind of person. And that's what's fun to discuss after you go to a comedy show. But if there's only one person, well, then there's no comparison. So they've got to just compare bits. So they're like, I don't like the fucking bed sheets bit.
Versus that. Well, I'm obsessed talking to non-comedians, because I mainly just talk to comedians about comedy. Like, I never talk to non-comedians about comedy. Mm. But of late, I've started chatting to some people that are not comedians.
What, like people at the gigs?
Yeah, or like friends or whatever that have gone to see a bit of comedy and just chatting to them about
Didn't sound like you liked it. You were just saying how annoyed you were that they gave you any feedback.
Not about me.
Unless
about
we're talking about joke structure, I have a fucking panic attack.
But it's interesting to see what people like and what they pay attention to, because ultimately the audience are the only ones that matter, really, when you think about it. It's like, we should be trying to impress them. Obviously, you've got to be doing it for yourself and for the right reasons, but, they have got to... They're buying a ticket.
Well,
if they all disappear,
unless you're a comedian's comedian. Me, personally, I'm a comedian's comedian's comedian.
What does that mean?
Yeah, what does
means
that mean?
Some of my friends are very well-respected.
Yeah, how good is secondhand credibility? I've dined out on being friends with fucking
famous
comics.
Yeah, one of my favorites too, I might text him right now.
Ultimately, you want to get the audience into a place where they are not... We were talking about this just before you arrived, Sam.
Why should you pop the mics on? We could have got it down.
Not everything needs to be fucking for performance, right? That moment where the audience feel as though they collectively have to get you over the line.
You know
that, like, those gigs where you're doing whatever, where your eyes are darting around and that your voice is a bit caught in your throat, and they can feel it on, like, a primal level. Like, oh, God, this...
Which is just any new room. That's something I realised, which is what we were talking about before you got here, Sam. I think I realised that, I mean, certainly not when I started, that most people in the room, when it's, like, all new people, like an open mic is what it's called, the audience are very aware that everyone is absolutely shitting themselves. Yes. When I was doing that, I thought that they all thought it was kind of a normal comedy show and they were maybe people's friends or something, and they knew it wasn't the best in the world, but they couldn't tell that we were absolutely having a panic attack the whole time. But they absolutely can.
No, they can, because we're fucking humans and we can tap into that very...
Well, now you are. It's extremely obvious. Yeah. People are physically shaking. Attention.
But it's, you can feel it in the room. Like, say a night like that where, you know, they felt like they need to get someone over the line, and then someone gets on and just fucking flames the room and has total confidence. And you can feel that relief of, like, the letting go of, like, someone's in control.
Oh, my God.
Someone's in control.
All the time it shows. Like, a lot of the time, a few dodgy acts are, well, not dodgy, but, you know, they might be newer acts or whatever. And someone that gets on that just goes, the audience just go, oh. Like, they take a breath. Yeah. You can hear them they almost belong just go, here. Oh, like
and they own the space, and I'm no longer responsible. I can surrender to just being an audience member taken on a journey rather than feeling like I need to actively participate. Yeah. Like, my reactions will be spontaneous. I will laugh, you know, like if I sneeze, like it just happens. Yeah, yeah. But I'm not sitting. You know that gritted teeth, like... That grin that people have when they're sitting in the front row, the wide eyes. Oh, yeah. And
it's emotional labor.
Yeah, it's awful.
It's a lot of emotional labor. It's really bad, particularly if someone's quite empathetic. The thing that happened, that hammered at home for me, is like the first open mic in Sydney, which didn't exist when you started, which I'd be interested to ask about, but the Mug and Kettle started, which was a sign-up night where you could go and you didn't have to be booked or anything. You just signed up and anyone could perform. And there were people there for some reason. It was at a pub in Glebe. I didn't really understand why anyone would be in the audience, but I'm like, yeah, probably just to see cool inner-city comedy. It's like New York. My God, this is why people are here, and they're supporting us. And that's enough for me. And a few years later, I was talking to some guy at a party, and then we were talking about comedy, and he's like, oh, you know what I used to love to do? I used to go to Mug and Kettle. Did you ever perform there? I was like, yeah, I used to perform there. And I'm like, oh, so you like that? And he's like, yeah. Me and my mates would smoke a joint and then go in and then just laugh at how shit they were.
Oh, right. The humanity.
And I'm like, oh, was that, like, what percentage of the people in the audience back then were just laughing at us? Probably quite... Probably a relatively high percentage. So many.
Yeah.
I feel like
I was like New. It was like New York.
Well, I've chatted
like that in New York as well.
Yeah, probably.
Because like I've chatted to friends that have come. I'm like you. Like I try to not get friends to go see like one person shows or whatever. I'll be like, mortifying. Go see some like a bunch of people. You get better bang for your buck. You can have a drink, get drunk. Like you don't want to ruin a friend's night or whatever. Do you know? And they take pride being like. If someone bombs, they're like, we want to see someone bomb.
Oh, you want? Yeah. Part of it because you just don't want to see an hour of it.
Totally. The spectacle of someone doing it is so outrageous. To go up with that much confidence and to fail so publicly is almost like the most engaging thing you could ever watch in your life. So I think there's a percentage of that.
Oh, it's great.
In every show.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, ideally.
Which is why you get laughs when you go well.
It's releasing tension.
Yeah.
Totally. That's what I've said about all crowd work. I think that's all releasing tension. Most of the laughs, people will chat to someone in the front row. They'll be like, what do you do, mate? And then they'll say something and then they'll make a joke about what that guy does. Often that's not very funny, but people are still laughing anyway.
It's real.
It's because it's real, but I think it's also people laughing because they're not being talked to. So it's just, they're just like...
We laugh loud enough, they won't talk to us.
Like, it's like, well, that's over, I suppose.
Dude, so much of it is...
No more picking anyone.
So much of it is the fucking, the energy, and I really do think it's that releasing the audience from the obligation of feeling like they have to get you over the line. And I think so, like... That's what the audience actually think is a successful gig, not how funny the material was or how charismatic the person was. Like, just that I got to sit there and I didn't feel like I had to be responsible for not for allowing this person not to have a fucking nervous breakdown.
But totally.
Did you feel that? Did you go to shows before you were? Because I would go to a few comedy gigs before I was became a comedian.
Yeah.
And I do remember never wanting to be spoken to. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I remember the huge sense of relief when you weren't.
Totally.
Or if you were sitting up the back or whatever. I used to love when they would chat to other people. Some people, not everyone is like this, by the way. I've got friends and shit that love to be chatted to. But a lot of people do. Were you the same?
Well, I never really watched comedy. I was a bar guy at the Comedy Store for a year and a half before I ever got on stage.
Really?
Yeah.
Classic.
Yeah.
Well, can I say?
Dude.
That's very New York.
It's very New York, right?
Was the store good back then or bad?
Dude, the store was so fucking good back then.
Really?
It was so fucking, like,
it pre-century?
Yeah. And, like, I don't mean to be, like, you know, nostalgic, but it was, like, it was
Century is the current company that owns it. It's not saying it was the last century.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
But I heard Century? Before Century, it went into a dip, which is why Century ended up taking
it. There was some bad business decisions, but it was run by a guy, the pub manager, the guy that owned the business, was just, I don't know anything about comedy, so I've hired the manager to run the place, and he was just a fucking legend. He understood comedy so well, but without any aspirations to actually get on stage himself. So this was back in the day where
where it is now.
Yeah, Moore Park. So the structure was Tuesday night was open mic, and you had to like get a recommendation to get on open mic.
Yeah,
and so you would do 5-minute spots, and a lot of the time, like people like Will would come and host just to kind of foster it, and it was a great hangout. And then if you did really well for a few weeks at Tuesday open mic, you got new comics Wednesday night, so you expand to a 10-minute spot.
Oh my god! There
was a real track that you could go, and so then if you started doing really well on Wednesday night, you'd get half support spot on Thursday night. And the structure of show on Thursday, Friday, Saturday was 2 to 3 support acts in the first half, and then a headliner, usually an American. So this is where I saw Marin before WCF. This is where Brendan Burns, Paul Provenza, Stanhope, like. They would fly like Stanhope out for 2 weeks for a 2-week run.
Yeah.
So the way I met all those guys was before I even started doing comedy. It was just me bringing them whiskey in the green room and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah.
So it was this weird thing where within like 6 to 8 months of me being there, the comics would talk to me because I was just on the side of the stage, with a tray waiting for orders. It was just a very different vibe.
Totally, yeah.
So in that sense, I really liked it. Whenever I was in the audience and a comic would call me out, it was like, don't fucking look at me, because that feeling of you're on. But when you're playing the quote-unquote role of the bar guy, kind of friends with the comic.
Is that how you got into it? You got a few laughs that way?
Yeah, well, it was this weird thing where it was, that was always the plan. I always wanted to do stand-up, but was terrified to. And my girlfriend at the time was like, why don't you get a job at the place and just get used to the environment of it. And then eventually
just get a job at the
place. Get a job. And that's exactly how it happened. And after about 18 months, I was like, oh, I really want to get on. And they gave me a Saturday night spot and I fucking ate shit.
Hang on.
It was like the worst.
Well, Saturday?
Ever having done.
Oh, it was like a fucking... It was a
mate, you got to do Tuesdays and Wednesdays.
It was a practical joke on the fucking manager's
part. How long did you have to do?
Oh,
because what was it? Did you say, MC support, then feature headline.
Yeah. Have I not told you guys the story of my first acts? Gig?
Three acts.
Yeah, it was like three. Well, sometimes it was one. It was just depending on. It was different each time.
Jesus.
But like at that time, me and Nick Sun basically would perform at the Comedy Store like 3 times a week for 3-4 years. That was that's where we came up. Yeah. We just like really were always there. And obviously, it's very different now, and there's no. Judgment call on that, but it was a very different culture.
Well, it runs a lot less now.
Yeah. So, like when I was 4 years in, I was supporting Marc Maron on a Saturday night at the Comedy Store.
So good.
And also the culture of it was very much like, you're the comics, do whatever the fuck you want to do. There is no obligation to kill. There is no obligation to do a raffle. It's just go out there and like Pete Blacklock, the manager at the time, was a real celebrator of, just... fucking weird comedy. So, when Nick would get up and get on all fours and snort like a pig for 5 minutes on a Saturday night for 350 people, that was fine.
Yeah.
It was all good. And that in turn gave you the confidence to go in weird directions. And a lot of the time that stuff would go over really well. Whereas nowadays, I don't know if something that confronting would...
Maybe it's hard to say.
If it did well, I think it'd be fine.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't get that, you wouldn't get the chances for it not to.
Yeah, and the fact that you don't have the chance to fail, I know...
Makes you be more conservative.
Well, sure. I know the last time I performed at the store, I had a stick up my ass and I could not relax. And it was like being in a weird nightmare because it was like, this is so familiar. This place is so familiar to me, but it's like being in a bad dream. But I can't get my fucking rhythm going.
I was thinking, to stick up your ass. That sounds pretty edgy.
Let's yank it out on stage, flick it at the crowd.
It is like the store now, especially when you do the showcases, it is very rapid fire. You just get up and you've got to go, everyone basically everyone's doing 10 minutes, about that, and everyone goes bang, bang, bang. But it is like, so it is kind of like...
More rapid fire, less firecracker.
There's almost no firecracker. If you ever do, it is weird to do anything longer there. Like, it does feel weird. I know what you mean. Like, it is kind of like, I mean, especially with your experience of it before. But now, to me, it's completely associated with 10 minutes and then having no choice.
Showcase.
Bam, 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 bam.
But what's this first gig story? Oh. So you got put up on the pro night. Where everyone was expecting
it was like
a professional show.
Black lock, because like he could tell that I was like that I wasn't going to do well.
So he's never done it before. Quite funny.
Pete Blacklock.
He was like this week.
Oh, he was a vicious cunt. He was so funny, but you know he was malicious. But he was he was really just savvy about comedy. Like we'd never heard about Stanhope or Maron.
He doesn't sound that savvy if he's putting you to.
No, it was the whole thing was to humiliate me in front of all the fucking colleagues that I'd spent a year and a half.
Oh, okay, that's savvy. Yeah, that's savvy.
Terrific.
Humiliation. Oh yes.
So I get up. And I knew how inappropriate it was. To put me on a Saturday night in front of a full crowd. Never done comedy in my life.
Did you know
before.
You were being fucked with, or you thought this was
I
just
suspected I was being fucked with, but
if you did well,
like,
it would be like...
You know, you've been building to this.
You're choosing to believe what you want to believe.
Yeah.
Well, you haven't. You haven't built to
but
this.
But it's also like you don't know what you don't know.
He poured the whiskeys,
and I had a whole fucking... Like, it was a structured, written set.
How long are you doing?
I was supposed to do 5 minutes. So, the boat...
In front of who, sorry?
What do you mean?
Who's the comedian after you?
I was the opening act of the entire night. So Gary Hu was emceeing and Tony Woods was headlining.
I think Tony Woods has got a Netflix thing.
Oh, really?
Just quite a side thing. I saw some. Anyway.
Right. Continue. So I my previous job prior to the comedy store was working at Starbucks. And I'd been fired for giving a sandwich to a homeless man, among other things, and had a lot of like.
Oh, wait.
And I was in that. Yeah.
Hang on, among other things, was masturbating at work?
I just shopped in the Frappuccino machine.
Exactly, but it was mainly the charity that got me fired. Yeah,
they used the charity as an excuse. Yeah,
I pat the head of an orphan.
You would never have said I stole money amongst other things. What was the other thing? Oh, I gave a sandwich to the
homeless. Shop in the toilets. And you know, I was like, whatever, 23 and like fucking high on listening to fucking Bill Hicks's rant in E minor every night and like, yeah, I'm gonna be like the fucking reincarnation of Bill Hicks. And so the plan was I would get up and I did get up in a Starbucks apron.
Oh right.
This is so mortifying.
This already sounds terrible.
This is the most mortifying.
I
honestly,
like the apron.
Dude,
he's like the apron.
Yeah.
This is 15 years ago, and like it's still like I still have like Vietnam flashbacks where I'm punch drunk, about it. So the plan.
You haven't donated anything to a homeless man since. Sorry, mate. Got a weird past with it. Can't do it.
So the plan was I would get up in the Starbucks apron playing like the cliched happy Starbucks employee.
Right.
Like, hey, everybody.
You're going to do a character,
essentially. Yeah, so I get up and the plan
is...
The plan is you get up and you go, hey, everybody, what's the difference between Arabica beans and Robusta beans? And then I think the punchline was Starbucks would never serve Robusta beans or whatever. And the whole point was like a deliberately bad joke.
Okay.
That was the point. Yes. And then when they didn't laugh, like great way to start your first ever joke that deliberately doesn't get laughed.
Always start with anti-comedy.
Yeah. And then when they didn't laugh, I'd go, raw, and like tear the apron off and throw it on the ground and be like, ah, I was tricking you, Starbucks is fucking shit. And the whole audience would be like, yeah,
yes.
And like go and burn down Starbucks.
Good. I can see what
there's something there,
work,
whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I am back.
One of those things where you think, when I think you're going through it in your head, you think people are going to be really focused on every little bit of minutia.
Yeah.
And they're going to be like, whoa.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
really,
yeah.
Like half of them are ordering a drink. They're like, oh, Starbucks? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
They come
oh,
back
that
to
was
a
shit.
At the punt. They missed the setup. They only hit the
Also, that classic rookie mistake where you believe that the audience has the same amount of vitriol or passion for the thing that you're so angry about. And it's like, they don't give a fuck. It's just Starbucks.
Totally.
They don't care. Oh, shit.
Half of them are probably like, oh, I like this Starbucks.
Totally.
I can't wait to see what
this guy's
good.
So nice.
I love to get down to Starbucks.
Hurry up, Abina!
So I go backstage into the little green room, and I'm wearing the apron.
Just got greener.
Yeah. And Tony Woods is back there, and he just looks up, and he goes, hey, man, I'm Tony. And I go, oh, man, like, obviously just so out of my
And you're
depth.
Nervous?
So nervous.
Yeah.
And he just looks at me, and he goes, how long have you been doing comedy? And I go, to tonight's my first gig. And without missing a beat, he just goes, you gon' die. So,
do you still then at that point think, like, it's going to be fine?
No, it's like, it's fine. I've rehearsed
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
I've
yeah, yeah, totally.
I still think it's going
to
be fine.
Well, you know, it's back to that thing I was saying before about, like, that it's the reason that I don't practice my material before I go on stage, because this is what happens. I choke and I get caught in recitation.
You know that now, if you saw someone in a Starbucks apron who said, it's going to be my first gig, you know that you in your head you'd go, oh, of course, they're going to have a horrible day.
Of course. I would have been Tony Woods going, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, dude. I mean, you know, my favorite thing is to go up to new comics just before they're about to walk on stage and whisper in their ear, there's a Hollywood producer in the audience, oh, don't yeah. fuck it up. So, Gary Hu, and you know, he did that fucking MC thing where he's like, oh, I've seen this bloke around town. It's like, no, you haven't. Mm. Never done comedy before.
No, he did. In Starbucks,
yeah. I've seen this bloke heaps, actually.
Yeah, when I get my latte every
my
morning.
My venti frappuccino. And so he builds me up and he's like, go to the stage, and you bloke on the scene, better word. And I come out and it's just like, you know, I mean, if you've never been in front of an audience in that setting before, you can't even relate to it. But you know that, like, the lights, like, on your face, yeah. And time's just like, it's like you're moving through molasses.
You can't really
see. The big thing is you don't realize you can't see much. A fucking that's the thing that's so shocking. Yeah. Like, that's what people need to know before they do stand up. Totally. A lot of the time you can't see shit up there.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And you know the like the Nixonian beads of sweat on your upper lip, and you're just very like. You know when you can feel that, like the catch in your throat and all that?
I don't know. Disgusting. I don't know if these are all universal experiences.
I'm pretty chill.
Yeah. Cool. So
the anomaly's back.
So I get up and I'm like, hey, everybody, what's the difference between Arabica beans and Robusta beans? And no response. Okay. As if Starbucks would ever serve Robusta beans. And then I reach, and by this stage I'm already diminished. Like, even if it's not going to go well either way.
I feel like
and
you're not selling the character,
exactly,
probably.
And I yank the apron, and instead of it coming off, the knot at the back just tightens, and the apron won't come off.
No.
And now I'm and I said, no. And I'm like standing there going like, oh, it was, the apron was supposed to come off.
You said that?
Yeah. Like, just completely, like, all fucking, all guards down. And I'm, like, pulling at it, and it's just not coming off. So I'm like, oh, well, I'll just do it with the apron on. Yeah, Starbucks is really shit. can I get through that? I get through, like, three jokes, and it's, like, dead silence.
Not even
dead,
a
like,
ripple.
Pin drop. And then you start hearing, you know that Dance and Homer episode of The Simpsons? When he's, like, in Capital City and he's dancing around and he's been a big hit in Springfield.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and then he goes to Capital City and he's like, you know, you couldn't hear anything. All you could hear was the smart-ass comments from the crowd. And, oh, this might fly in Springfield. This is Capital City. It was that kind of stuff. Like, whoa, real edgy Bill Hicks and that kind of stuff.
Yes.
And...
someone said that.
Yeah,
that's
said, real edgy. Real edgy Bill Hicks. I'm not fucking joking.
Anyone in the comedy store even knows who Bill Hicks is.
Real edgy Bill Hicks is a literal thing that was fucking said. Bill Hicks was very big in the fucking early to mid 2000s.
Yeah.
But anyway, after about God knows how long, I didn't get through a quarter of the act, shaking.
Was it hot before you got on? Like,
no, I feel like
was the MC killing?
It was Gary Hu. It was fucking
destroying.
Was
fucking
the comedy store in 2004 or whatever. Of course, he was smashing. And I'm like shaking like a leaf. And after 2 minutes, just kind of put the mic back in the stand and went, I'm gonna go now. And just kind of walked off stage, went straight backstage, and just like threw up everywhere. No. And Tony Woods is like, hey! And then all I can hear is Gary Hu coming back on stage going, yeah, all right. That was Ben Elwood, everybody, and it was just like I got up. I think the night after or the next night. But had I not got up very soon after, I like never would have fucking done
so
it.
So, in summary, you bombed for going short and other reasons.
Yeah, never go under time, guys. Don't walk off stage till your time.
Maybe a time thing. There are a few other issues, but I won't go into those.
That's traumatic.
It was
traumatic.
Really fucking ugly. But, you know,
was
I
the
think...
bar or the manager that, guy?
Did he have to go work?
That was no, the next night. But the worst thing was, in the silence, the only thing I could hear was Pete Blacklock up the back of the room going,
Oh, fuck.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, I think it's... you know, whatever, everyone has their own entry into it. I think for me it was good to eat shit that hard early on. I think if I'd been one of those...
I feel like I'm getting a sense of the genesis of this nihilistic outlook.
Yeah.
Like, what was... Did either of you smash your first gig?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, the second one was really bad, but the first couldn't have gone better.
Well, you reckon it was just that fucking, the energy?
I don't know. I think Born to Do It.
That's really cool.
Handsome and funny. Very nice.
No, I think it was just like a lot of... but I mean, I wasn't trying to do the Comedy Store on a Saturday night. I did a Raw Comedy Heat, and so it was like a very nice crowd that was...
That's the thing, it's the Raw, mine was the Raw Comedy too, like they were just supportive.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And in my head it went well, but it probably didn't go... That's the other thing, it's like you think, like when you're a new comic, you think you have good sets, but as you get to become a good comedian, you understand what a good set actually is.
Yes.
And I mean, I know I got laughs, but I don't think it was a good set.
But in those early days you hear like a titter... And in your mind, it translates to like a...
Well, you can't believe anyone's laughed at all. I remember bombing really hard the next time. I got through to the next round and bombed. Couldn't have bombed harder. And then didn't do it for like 7 months after.
Really? Just too scarred up?
Just, I was like, oh, I guess that's not for me.
I did songs. So I did pretty good the like first bunch of times. Because I had like a little song that I worked on. I just executed the song.
That's nice.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And like there were funny things
that's
in there.
That's such a great thing to have early.
And if you remember it, it's
bomb
just...
Bomb-proof almost.
If they rhyme and there's jokes, it's like...
People love remembering things. If you remember a long fucking train of sound, they love that.
They love a bit of fucking effort. They think that if you don't... I mean, there's almost more effort to write normal punchlines to get up there. But if you bring the guitar or a keyboard, they're like, we're going to laugh just because you had to lug something from the car.
Looking back as well, I think there was a bit of... it's like when you see a nine-year-old busker. Like, I was quite young. I was, like, 19. It's like, I think it was like, oh, he's cute. Like,
he's
good on
doing
him.
Doing it.
Like, you know, a young man having a go. And I'm there like, yeah, it's New York. It's like, oh, there's probably quite a lot of pity in that those enthusiastic responses.
Yeah.
That's
but right. Then you did, weren't you on Comedy Channel? That's the other thing I know about your early days.
Oh, yeah.
Is that you were on the Comedy Channel.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Early into...
Like a year in.
And also, you're doing comedy in Sydney. Because I'm obsessed. I started in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And I'm always obsessed with what, like, Sydney was. Yeah, probably what, mid-2000s, early 2000s?
So I started in 2005 and... Like mid-2005. So the scene was, it was like there was a new comic every 3 or 4 months. Comedy is this fucking industry now. Whereas back then it was just this, like I said, it was just this thing that...
Maybe it was
strays.
A bit more in Melbourne. I think in Sydney, what you're saying is true.
Sydney was very scrappy. It was like I came up with Nick Sun, and then like a couple of years after that, Hutton showed up. And then Jen Carnivale. Yeah. And so we were kind of just doing our thing, which for some reason everyone started calling us, the alternative comics. Mm. I think that comedians, what's that Patton Oswalt thing from the early 2000s, comedians of comedy?
Yeah.
I think that was a very popular thing in the zeitgeist. Yeah. So everyone's like, oh, they're just trying to be those guys. And it's like, we're just doing what we think is funny.
Mm. But it just happens to be alternative and cool.
Yeah, been really cool.
It's organic, guys. We're not copying anyone.
And then and then pretty early, we were, you know, putting on shows that were, you know, playing music over the top of people and like heckling, you know, just kind of rowdy, raw, like raunchy shows. So it was just a lot of fun, but it was that real sense of almost nihilism of like, this isn't going anywhere. Like, we're not going to ever make it, whatever making it is. Now, I mean, this is pre-social media, you know, not pre-the internet, but, you know, like the idea that you could upload and share a gig and have it seen by a million people within 24 hours. It's like, you know, it was just what happens in the room. So I think everyone was just very locked into that. Like, let's, you know, have fun and work out our fucking demons. Very self-indulgent.
And then, so from this, so there was kind of like your established comedians, you guys are new, doing whatever. And then that's just what Sydney comedy at that point. Because I feel like Melbourne at that point probably was the opposite. It would have had the comedy festival.
Well, because you had all the comedy, the festival and the shows were all filmed down in Melbourne. You know what I mean? I think there was a path for that where it's like, oh, I could get on, you know, whatever. Rove
like
show
Spicks
or something.
And Specs or whatever.
Yeah. Whereas in Sydney, it was just like, there's nothing here.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah,
and I think for
totally.
Us, and you know, we had that whole wank of like purity and all that shit. So I think, I know, I can only really speak for me and Nick, but I know at the time, for us, like, being able to support Stanhope or being able to support Maron was like, whoa, that's cool. Like, that's right. fucking sick. Yeah.
I would and say, that's maybe, so much cooler. Is that than, partly because there's not so much stuff to look up to, so you're, like, the people that start doing it, which is probably true to me, are people who are fan of, like, American or English comedy. Yeah. It's, like, less so you're going to big shows and being kind of...
Yeah. And I think it was that thing of, like, you know, the particularly those guys... was so influential at that time, you know, in like influencing the way we thought about things and stuff. To that, so to not only be in the same room as them, but to be like supporting them, it was almost like, oh, I'm done. Like, I don't actually need anything else than this, which, you know, is detrimental going forward because you don't take gigs very seriously and, you know, trying to burn things down and all the rest. Hence, back to what we were talking about earlier, all the apology tours. Yeah, the apologies weren't just for, bitching about people. It was also for, you know, going to gigs and actively burning them down and like pissing on the flames and laughing and how funny it was to ruin a night.
Totally.
It's not that funny. It's very self-indulgent. I mean, I'm glad we had that period, like pre, you know, cancel culture and all that. Not that we were doing anything that was, you know, really grubby or gross, but
no, I went to a few of them and you were saying the N word quite a lot.
Yeah.
And
you're big part of my ass.
But also for most of my bits.
The face paint was unnecessary. I thought it was the black face paint.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
That was actually my favourite part. I just wanted to.
That's nice.
We've all burned, you know, had a bad set and ruined.
No, I remember when I started in Sydney, Australia, and Nick Sun and yourself, two of my favourites. That kind of scene had already was like pretty prevalent.
What year
did
you start?
2009.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
so there was quite a lot of like anti comedy y kind of like, yeah, who cares? Focus on authenticity. Not much of a path to glamour.
Yep.
There were a lot of like overweight men in their early 30s and late 20s with very dark spirits who looked up to people like Ben.
Yeah.
And it was all of...
No, but like lots of like illegitimate children.
Right.
It was a weird vibe. But I think that there was like a lot of fun around that. It felt quite subversive. But I do remember being at a few shows with like Nick Sun, for example, where that's like the most magical thing you could see. He's being also... Everyone else is being kind of normal. And he's being subversive. And then other ones where, he would just, like, scream or something.
Yeah.
And it did feel a bit like, oh, I mean, you know, it would have been good to do a joke or something.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, it was just that thing where it was, like, it was difficult to bottle. So you couldn't, there was no rhyme or reason to when it would work.
Mm.
I once saw Nick writhe around on the floor for about 20 minutes screaming while the Seinfeld theme played on a loop endlessly. And it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life.
Mm.
But if you try to replicate that the next night, it would have been like, oh, it's just an insane person
riding
around on the floor.
Mm.
But, you know, I mean, I don't even... I talked to Nick about this these days, and it's like, what were we doing? What were we trying to prove?
Yeah.
And I do think a lot of it...
But I think everyone's subverting the thing before them. So when you...
Yeah.
Because, like, Sydney before that, and I wasn't there, but it was a lot of, like, kind of blazer, suit jacket,
Yeah,
like...
I think we were very angry because we... loved, you know, people like Stanhope and early... Like, Maron was a very different comic than he is now. Like, there's a great album, Tickets Still Available, which is, I think, 2005.
Yeah, it's
fucking amazing. It's amazing.
What about Brendan Burns?
Yeah, I mean, I like Brendan. He wasn't a huge... I met Brendan after.
Is he Sydney originally?
Perth.
Right, and then went to the UK. Yep, gotcha.
But he was around in the... Because I went out with it when I was in year 11. Mm. I went out with a girl who had... I think worked or interned at the Comedy Store, and I liked comedy, and that was like, I'm like, oh my God. I went out with, and her favorite was Brendan Burns and his albums, and like said that she met him there.
Yeah, Brendan would come and just incinerate the Comedy Store. It was fucking hilarious. So I think we were all, and you know, we loved like Chris Morris stuff, like Brass Eye and Jam and all this stuff that was really, like, really on the edge of, is this even comedy or is this just horror masquerading as comedy? I think that stuff really appealed to us. And then, you know, you would go to a gig and it was like, oh, get over it. And I think we were just pissed off. And it was just that typical young person rebellion thing of like, oh, you want, well, fucking, you've been having a good time, have you? You've been having a good time? Well, I'm going to fucking ruin your night.
But it's like, so I think it's quite classic because it's like, and that happened to me to some extent as well. It's like what you're into, which is like American and kind of, and American and English comedy scenes are kind of just older and like they've gotten to like the fifth level of subversion.
Yes.
And to more kind of interesting stuff. Yeah. And you're still at like level two, let's say. here, and then you're seeing level two, and you're aware of level five. You're like, totally. I'm going to try and get to level five. I'm not really ready, but
100%. And I think it was that frustration of like this stuff. It's not like you even need to seek this stuff out really anymore. Like South Park's on TV every week. Like this stuff's really accessible by a mainstream Australian audience, but it still, you know, hasn't caught on, and we're still kind of laughing at, you know, pretty naff shit.
Mm.
Which I'm less judgmental of these days, but you know, but you also, when you're young, you want to tear it all down.
But you also realize, like, the naff shit is like, if you think there's naff shit here, even, you know,
100%
in the States, the UK, more naff shit.
Oh, than, that's just, you know, not what just, you'd be into if you were
totally
young.
Yeah. But because the market's bigger, there's like more of an avenue. Mm. But also, yeah, I think if you're trying to do, I mean, maybe you didn't value. I mean, I'm not speaking for you guys at all, but it's like there is value, I think, in being.
Sounds like you are.
I don't know, but
tell me who I am.
You trying to bring down a gig, not bring down or tear it down. I don't know. I just think there is still value. The audience would care more than you realize. Do you know what I mean?
There was value to us in the sense of, I think very early on we even articulated how afraid we were of. Well, I know this is where I was coming from. I can't speak solely for Nick, but I was so afraid of dying on stage,
yeah,
like just so terrified of it.
Do you think it had something to do with the first gig?
Probably, yeah. Or the whole thing, the ego and that externalizing, you know, tell me I'm good.
Yeah.
And so it was that classic petulant thing of like, oh, if I'm kind of half dying, I am going to tank this so fucking hard. So you don't, it's not even that you're indifferent to me, you actively hate me and want me off
what you're saying
right now. And it's like, you know, and then you like own that. You own it and you feed on the hate and you're stronger for it.
But
and
also, I mean, sometimes that can get you
out. That's what I'm saying. Sometimes you probably then from that would turned it. And like, and then you're a god, even more of a god than you could have ever been before.
But there's a fine line. Like there's a fine line between doing it when you're kind of under control and going crazy. Like I went crazy with it. Like I would be, I'd be doing gigs where I'd be doing really well. Mm. And then I'd turn on the crowd for liking me too much. Like, fuck you! You know, like, how dare you laugh at me? It's an insult. I'm like, whoa, what are you doing?
Dude, we've all felt that though. I mean, you're like, you shouldn't be laughing this much.
Yeah, and
it's
like,
not that funny.
Just kind of the contempt for the audience. And again, like doing it purely selfishly and forgetting, like, you do have something of an obligation to the audience and your fellow comics, whoever's on before you or after you, or the MC.
I mean,
kind of.
In the same way, but it's just all a balancing act. You have an obligation, I think, firstly to yourself, obviously. Yeah. You've got to do something that's true to you. Yes, people have paid money, and like, I think they
depends where you are. Sometimes they haven't.
True, yeah, totally true. But I mean, your goal should be to try to entertain them at some point.
Should it?
Yes,
these are the kind of questions I had to ask myself pretty early.
Yeah,
going
after
up
the guys were not enjoying your, they were stoned watching you, hoping someone would bomb.
Yeah, I think
it depends on the gig.
Yeah, it depends.
If you're doing Saturday night at the Comedy Store, yes, you have an obligation to entertain these people. They spent $30 on a ticket. They've spent $20 on parking. On and on and on. They've come out. You do have an obligation to that. At like a fucking shitty open mic. No, your only obligation is to yourself.
Right. Yes. No. I think. Yeah. No. You are kind of right. But I think at its core, though, you still. I had this for example. I did a show the other night. You did it, Tom. It was pretty shit. Like. You know, not many people turned up or whatever. You went, then you left when did another gig.
I
had to close, and I felt
there was one family there of like a big family of nine. You know, when they all know each other, and like you're trying to like ask them who they are and kind of do
jokes,
but then they know more about each other, so like you can't get to anything funny because they've been living with each other for 15 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, and everyone kind of was pretty good trying to entertain them or whatever. I went up last year. I just took a notebook up and just, like, did all my new jokes. And, like, so I'm probably not caring about them at all.
But I still
value their feedback.
Yeah, but it's self-serving. Like, you don't value their feedback because you care about their reaction. You care about their reaction because it's informing what you're going to do at the next gig.
Yes. So, ultimately, everything I did was selfish.
Yeah. I think the difference between the scene now and then is...
Okay, I see what you're saying.
I think the difference between the scene now and then is that we were... consistently rewarded for our bad behavior.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I think that's what it was.
Well, it was in. You did it enough where it became, when I showed up, it was a genre. It was an established part of the, whether you don't like, I mean, you pretend to not like that it was called alternative comedy, but...
Oh, part of me likes it, but yeah, I feel like... But part of me doesn't understand it either, because we weren't aiming for that. We were just doing
what
we thought was
funny. But
it's also
kind of funny in Australia to be like alternative comedy.
Yeah, what does that even mean?
It's like, what do you, like, there is
well,
some
it means,
kind of like...
no, it means they were influenced by people in America that are on level five, and yeah. No one here was, kind of had done that before.
But that's
no,
the thing, to us it wasn't like, oh, we're reinventing the wheel.
No, exactly.
It's just like, oh, we're just copying the people that we really like. That's
yeah,
all
exactly.
we're really
which
doing.
Which is just all what anyone is doing.
Yeah,
any art form, I think.
Of course.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, that was a kind of a thing which made a bit more sense. I think if you showed up at a random pub gig and then did that a little bit, I feel like I'm exaggerating something. I remember one time, like, actual screaming. But yeah, maybe just a bit less obvious, like, set up punchline jokes, but a bit something a bit more crazy. That would be a bit more normal to have occurred. So people wouldn't be, like, the Booker, for example, wouldn't necessarily be angry at you.
Now...
No, back then,
back
because
then,
it was
yes.
a bit of a thing that people...
Yes,
oh, yeah.
yes, yes, yes.
One in yeah. four people is going to do something a bit weird.
Weird, yeah, yeah, yeah. Whereas I don't think that behaviour would be rewarded now. I think if you carried on like that, you would be fucking
well,
exiled.
It would be rightly seen as a bit of a strange act of disrespect.
I think it would almost work now.
If it was
there's
funny,
no
it would
one's
be fine.
Doing it, you know what I mean? Like yeah. It would be
fun if it was funny. It's
yeah,
just
it,
like
it
wouldn't...
Funny.
There was context for it where it wasn't just disrespect then, because
totally,
it was like,
yeah,
oh,
yeah.
there's a genre of people being crazy. Whereas
also,
now I think people would be like, are you just trying to fucking fuck with
fucking,
me, dude?
Yeah.
You come here
yeah, yeah, yeah.
and you just
I
sing
give you
a song
and
you don't...
Gig. I charge
exactly.
people money and you come here.
Exactly.
There's also the
take
grace
a
that...
shit on the stage.
There's also the grace that comes from, you know, like say someone like Nick, you know, when he would die, it was catastrophic. But when he would kill, it was like, transcendent. It was,
oh,
like
was
the funniest fucking thing we've
yeah.
ever seen.
Best. I remember being on forums when I was 18
yeah.
telling people that Nick Sun's the best comedian.
So there was that real sense in the audience of like, or amongst the comics or the bookers, where it was like, fuck, what's it going to be? It could either be awful or it could be fucking
yeah.
like something
I never got
never
to
seen
see
in your life.
It. I used before. He came back a bit when I was a few years in.
Mm.
I saw him have a great set of Crab Lab in Melbourne once, but like it was still. I never heard, because I wasn't around in the early days.
In terms of comedy, I think Nick is one of the only bona fide geniuses this country's ever produced.
Yeah.
Like, he's pretty good. He was on ABC Up Late or something at the time.
I saw, yeah.
I remember
yeah,
being in school and seeing that.
I saw that. I saw him do his Raw set before we ever met on TV, before I even started doing comedy. You know, oh, that guy's funny. And then all of a sudden, we were, you know, the first time we ever hung out, we did Magic Mushrooms together.
Was that when you were watching Eric? No.
No, that was a whole, that was years down the track.
Right. Tell us about the Comedy Central thing.
Yes.
What Comedy Central?
Also, before we go any further.
You were on Comedy Central.
Was I?
Some, I, because when I used to hear you on Triple J when I was, growing up.
But that's what I mean. Like, way too much given to me for,
it all happens at the right time.
Well, it happened at the right time,
you're
maybe spiritually,
right.
but not career-wise.
Yeah.
I was not in a fit mental place. To deal
to
with
capitalize.
Any of that. To capitalize on any of that.
For sure.
And again, you know, that like crippling self-loathing of like, fuck, you know, imposter syndrome and all that, you know.
Do you think you were doing comedy for what you thought other people thought was funny?
No.
It was still what you thought was funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was 100%. The problem.
That was, yeah.
That was, you,
that was the
no,
problem.
No, no, I don't think, because I think you need to do, ultimately, you have to care about the audience, but you have to do what you think is funny.
But when
I think it's
totally.
The other way,
but,
if you think doing it for other people.
But when you talk in terms of like, I think I've come to realize over the years that I probably never really wanted it that badly.
Because
you think about like compromise and... You know, back then it was like, that's a dirty word. That's disgusting. I would never do anything that I wouldn't want to do. But the reality is, if you're going to make it in anything, a bit of compromise is necessary, right? You occasionally got to fucking read a line
totally.
That you don't want
to
read.
Totally. Yeah.
And I think that I was so anti that I wonder if it was really me being this staunch kind of like, oh, I'm an individual, or if it was subconsciously going, you don't actually really want this.
Yeah.
And kind of almost deliberately blanching against that so that it couldn't go further.
But also just being like, I'm enjoying it though, but I'm only going to enjoy it if I'm doing it on my own terms.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
like
yeah.
a compromised version, I probably wouldn't enjoy it
yeah.
that much. So I'm just going to do this.
And I think
version
we've seen people that we know, you know, like the thing about compromise is, you know, like it's probably a necessary evil to a point, but I've seen people compromise to the point where it's like, who even fucking are you anymore?
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Like, and you haven't just compromised your artistic integrity, you've compromised, like, your just ethics in your soul.
Yeah.
And mm. you're kind of like, you know, part of a thing that I don't know that you would have been seeing yourself a part of years ago.
Well, I think the big thing about compromising is like, you know, it's got to be worth it, the thing you're compromising for. I always think I'm quite, you know, morally vapid, I think, sometimes. And like, I would.
I've always said that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's like.
Your best quality.
But I don't think the thing you're doing it for has just got to be, you know, pretty big. Like, it's, you know, it can't just be for 1500
Well, it's a balancing act, right?
A handshake. Yeah, obviously. Yeah, mm. totally. It's all a balancing act, but yeah.
Are there lines you wouldn't cross? Like, if you were offered a career for, you know, such and such, are there things that you'd just be like, nah, man, it's not worth it?
What's on the table?
Yeah, what do you got on the table?
And like, what are
whatever,
the things?
Whatever, fucking Netflix special, whatever you want. I don't know.
And then what are you going to do?
Yeah, but what are you going to do? Because I think we'd all take
Well, you got to maintain it. You got to fucking, you know, you got to work.
But no, but as in like, what
what I would mean, I have to, like, yeah. they get to...
What's the bad thing he has to do?
They get me a rider or something.
He has to do something racist?
No, like, I'm, look, I don't
that's such a crazy... That's
well, that's a moral
crazy
thing. It's like,
situation.
Yeah, do you have to... Yeah, well, exactly. You've got to say something.
You've
got to
do a mammy routine in your Netflix special.
No. Well, what if... Maybe, what if that actually happens? Because apparently that's what happens to politicians. The powers that be, they will let you become the next premier or something. And I mean, I've always maintained that who was the guy who fucking resigned over
Barry
a bottle
Farrell,
of wine?
Farrell,
they
yeah.
had some other shit on him, and they're like, "You're stepping down," and then he steps down. And then if you do it honourably, we'll say it was for quite an honourable reason. And then you know you're not shamed.
Mm.
I'm convinced that a lot of these people, they have to hand over or create even damning evidence against them that is held by the real power brokers,
yeah.
and
totally.
Then. They can kind of always have that. They've got Barry O'Farrell with like holding his balls like a nude photo, kind of like on Nathan For You. You know how he did
yeah,
that dieting
yeah.
exercise so where you know you've got to have something very, very embarrassing. But like, what if they do that with becoming a successful comedian? What if you have to film a video saying all sorts of racist epithets, and then they just hold that? And then, you know, you're off and away.
So I give it to Netflix.
Yeah, Netflix are like, well, you know, this is part of our onboarding procedure.
And basically
we need you to
they can
this.
Direct everything you do from now on.
Yeah.
It'll all be good for your career, but, like, you know, I often think about this.
I mean, except the original video.
Yeah, the original video.
Yeah,
out, original
I mean,
scene.
It's that's such an interesting one.
It's actually the deal with the devil. It's
yeah.
the same
well, that's
thing
the thing
that parable.
Like, you see this really, like, you know, to get away from comedy for a second, but you really see this with American politics right now, like the Faustian bargain that a lot of these Republicans made with Trump, you know?
Yeah,
and, like, I'm
totally.
Looking at people like Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham, and it's like, he's got to have photos of you doing something. There is no fucking way you can still be on board with this shit.
No, it's because he's got
I
a huge
think
base.
They hung out that much, did they? I think they just jumped on purely from a popular
but even,
standpoint.
But even that, it's like you've compromised. Like you're not even part of the party that you originally entered the game in. Like you're such a.
But they just
want to
win, I reckon. And now they're in a position where like half the Republican base is like they're more Trumpists. Like they kind
yeah.
of prefer Trump as a person over
yeah.
Republicanism, and they kind of because new people came in, it was good for the Republican Party. There were more votes, more
sure.
people support it. So now you're going to kind of balance that with yeah,
but
your
it's like
values.
You're not even you anymore. Like you
people.
Don't even have any values anymore. Like
oh,
it's just you've become this fucking creature
care,
for
power.
This power for
yeah.
the sake of power.
Mm.
And it's like sure, it can't be that great.
But you
oh,
think...
but that's what politics has always been. It's about power.
This seems like a level up of craziness, where it's like you're endorsing
yeah.
fucking like you know Jew lasers from space starting.
Yes.
Californian wildfires and stuff. Like, come
yeah,
on,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I mean,
but then
you not see
the
where
other
this
thing
goes?
That they, yeah, exactly. I mean, and, that's the other thing that they've kind of endorsed, though, I feel like, in politics over there, is because craziness has helped them for, like, or Republicans for the last, like, 4 years. And, like, a bit crazier, it's more clicks, more engagement online. And it's like, yeah, but where does it end? Like, it ends with people running into the Capitol and
totally.
Potentially
yeah.
killing
totally.
People.
Yeah, and you being beholden to defend... an insurrection and domestic terrorism because you've fucking gone so far.
But if you draw a line in it, the Trump people will be like, ah, now you're one of the bad guys. You're part of the
yeah,
system.
Like,
and...
But like, what's like a fucking like good night's sleep worth? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What's it worth to just be able to fucking live
yeah,
in your own head without being this craven,
that's the question,
disgusting?
Though. I reckon
fucking,
that'll be
yeah,
the interesting question of the next year. Like, where do they actually draw the line?
I don't think there is a line.
But I don't think there is
but
a line either. Because
someone will get killed.
They don't care about that. I don't think. The quest for power is far outweighs a good night's sleep.
And
but,
it does feel
and
like
it must
that,
feel better. Like if you're that person, it must feel so much better than a good night's sleep.
But the quest for power is now very... Because I agree they don't have any morals. They're not like they're
yeah.
not worried about like honouring their true political beliefs.
Yeah, political
but they're
going to
get maybe killed though. Like the crazier they get, the higher the stakes for the politicians. A lot of these politicians now are like worried about people, as they should be, running into the Capitol again and killing
them. Someone like Mike Pence, when they were fucking coming in there screaming, hang Mike Pence.
Imagine if they'd killed Mike Pence.
Can you imagine if they fucking hung him on live on C-SPAN? My God. And the guy has
Trump's like, I'm so sorry. Oh my
God. You know the worst part would have been, like, it would have been a meme in, like, 2 hours. Like, people would have been this is crazy. There would have been memes being like, gotcha, or something.
Gotta catch them all.
It'd be huge on TikTok forever. Like, fucking Huffington Post, like, top 20 things to happen, and like, it would be there, you know?
Dude, that's like a fucking Grimm's fairy tale, like, last paragraph fate, you know? You did everything the Mad King told you to do, you're the most sycophantic, you gave up every fucking moral fiber in your being, and then your reward was he sent a mob to hang you. And now you're exiled from your own party, and you're nothing. Like, you got nothing from it, no reward.
He almost, like, another week, and he would have been, like, got through it, and now he's, like, one of the most powerful people in the Republican Party, but no, you got hung.
Yeah, it's just, you know, and I think that's the thing about the moral compromise, like, with, you know, back to, like, entertainment or whatever. And like seeing how people kind of like give away a little bit of themselves, a little bit more. And then I think that's the thing with moral compromise. You know, not to fucking go straight to the Holocaust metaphor, but it is an easy one to go to. Mm. You know, no one starts with, hey, let's fucking throw kids in ovens. Like, it's it's an incremental thing.
So you're saying it's slowly, not that like yes or no decision. It's lots of tiny it's yes and no's.
Slowly chipping away. And all of a sudden, what was thought to be intolerable a year ago is suddenly like, yeah, right, I'll go there.
You know,
like those, the Republicans that are the most on board with Trump, you find videos of them 5 years ago going, oh, he'll destroy the Republican Party, this is the worst thing that could ever happen.
So and basically now, what you're implying is that Nazim Hussein doing an ad for koala mattresses is the same as the Holocaust.
Yes, it's exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same thing in my mind. That's what I say.
Well, I did an ad for koalas, so I'm one of those like Nazis who got to track down in New York somewhere.
Fuck. How do you live with yourself? Too much of anything makes you an addict. Teasing, squeezing, also why I got my own reasons. Smooth beat, great, nice, slick, nick, click. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. Quick, 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 quick. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. Quick, quick, quick. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. Quick, quick, quick. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. I was on 125 in St. Nick, waiting on a cab, standing in the rain. Under my heart, three clouds of pain. She got the best of me, what was her destiny? Maybe I should lick her with my 9mm. My mind is in a blur, cause you could never pay me to think this would occur. Me and this girl Jane Doe was living together. We were inseparable, no one could sever. At least that's what I thought, but later I fought with a substance and almost ended up in Supreme.